Welcome to the Invasion of the Remake podcast. I am your host, Jason Bishop. And of course, with me today is Trish Coughlin and Sam Stepanenko.
Hello.
I'm always late to introduce you, so I'm just going to incorporate my co-hosts right into the opening introductions from now on.
That sounds good.
Yeah, because sometimes I forget about it, and then it feels like it's just all about me, and it's totally not.
No.
I think everybody knows who we are by now anyhow, but...
They should, but
if they're tuning in and this is the first
every episode can be somebody's episode. First episode, right?
It's true. We could have an invasion virgin.
Yeah.
I like the sound of that.
Invasion it's virgin.
That sounds kind of really...
It's kind of like an oxymoron, like an invasion virgin.
Sounds like we're violating them.
Well, in some cases, we might be with some of the stuff we've made them watch. Or
true.
Well, considering what I just opened with, they're probably on board with that. That was the opening theme to our movie, Lady Hawk, from 1985. Now, that theme was, well, it was produced by Alan Parsons and composed by Andrew Powell. And I feel like Parsons' influence is more present in this than...
Yeah.
Anything, and it's this strange, the whole movie's this strange mix of that modern 80s pop instrumental vibe. I guess that electronic vibe along with orchestral music.
Well, they were trying something.
They were trying something.
So at least let them have that. At least it was slightly
different. I will let them have it because it exists. That's the only reason I will let them have it. It is also considered by some critics, and I'm not sure if I'll put it among them, but one of the worst soundtracks of all time. And despite that, it's had releases with additional music, and about 10 years after this movie was shot, they did another release with more music.
Well, what's interesting is when you look at the reviews for this, basically in the entirety of all the bad reviews are the music. You start off with, it always starts off with like, this is the worst music ever. I looked at all those reviews. I looked at like the first 20 that were the worst ones, and they're like, and then the fucking music. There's a couple that start off with like the worst music. There was one that was just... No. Terrible music.
It is not the only thing bad about this movie, but for every fault, it has a positive. So, and for the things I don't like, some people might like. So I have determined over the course of my life that I am not a fan of Matthew Broderick, but he was definitely riding a high horse. Yeah, he was, you know, coming off Ferris Bueller, and he was really couldn't do no wrong for about a 5-year span there.
Ferris Bueller after this?
Yeah, I think this was the end.
Ferris Bueller was 86.
This was kicking off. I guess this was before Ferris Bueller. Are you sure it was 86?
I'm positive.
Yeah. Everybody's going to yell at me. I don't care.
Yeah, no, but I mean, like, Ferris Bueller really is what exploded him. So what's weird is maybe this is the one thing he did before and he wasn't as well known.
Which, it's kind of baffling why Richard Donner went in that direction, because he originally was considering guys like Dustin Hoffman for that part.
Yeah.
So
he went to something much younger than his original thoughts, for sure.
Which, I think younger kind of works in its favor.
I think that Broderick brought a naivete, even for a character such as Mouse, that really added to his relationship with the captain and Isabel. Because he was still young, and I mean, he had a history as a criminal, but he still had this innocence about him that I really enjoyed.
And he gives a more paternalistic nature with Navarre and him, rather than they're just traveling together. Navarre sort of taking him under his wing. It gives it more a different dynamic than it would if it was an older guy, for sure.
Yeah, well, again, not a fan. Now, Lady Hawk, 1985, directed by Richard Donner. I don't think I have to go through his resume. Does anybody know this Richard Donner guy?
If they're listening to us, they should bloody well know who Richard Donner is.
Okay, just in case, he directed Superman 1 and most of 2, the good parts. Mavericks,
yeah,
Scrooge,
watch his cut, it's good.
The Omen, Goonies, Lethal Weapons 1, 2, 3, and 4. So, you know, if you haven't seen any of these movies, then what the fuck are you doing listening to this podcast? And the screenplay and the story was by Edward Kamara, who had penned Enemy Mine and Dragon, the Bruce Lee story. And the screenplay was also tweaked by Michael Thomas from The Hunger and Tom Mankiewicz from Superman, Live and Let Die, Diamonds Are Forever. He was a Bond guy. So, yeah, so lots of good people involved in this thing. It was budgeted at $20 million.
Ooh, for 85.
For 85, that's a pretty big budget for 85.
Yeah.
But the only box office number I could find, and I'm guessing it's domestic because it really feels too low for a movie that's remembered, maybe not, I'm not going to say cult movie or, you know, that's part of why we're covering it, but the box office was only 18.4, so it didn't even make its budget in the box office, and I couldn't find out if that was domestic or otherwise. I'm guessing that was domestic because it seems too low for a global take.
Yeah, like
even in the 80s, that's really, really low,
Yeah,
and considering like the fact that it seems to be like a foreign country, like it would maybe work better in foreign box office, like people would be like, oh, it's not Americanized as much.
Yeah. Now, of course, starring Matthew Broderick, Rutger Hauer, one of my favorite 80s action stars.
I know.
In his worst performance I've ever seen him in, just for the record.
Got to agree with you there. Michelle Pfeiffer, very early work of Michelle Pfeiffer.
This is, I think, her first role after Grease. So, after Grease 2, I should
say. She looks so young.
She looks so young, but, like, man, the woman is extraordinary.
She must be ageless, because I was looking up. She would have been early 30s when she did that part. I'm like, oh, my God, you look like you're 17.
She's not realistic. I don't think Michelle Pfeiffer is human. I think she's a creature from another planet who doesn't age.
Leo McKern, who was Imperius, he might not be a name people know, but he was in the first two Omens, so one of Richard Donner's boys. And TV series The Prisoner, he was number two.
Mm. Oh, how about that?
Yeah.
I never watched that TV series, so I wouldn't have recognized him.
I've seen him in a few other kind of British movies. Like, I've run across him.
John Wood was the Bishop. He was in War Game, Chocolat, Sabrina. He's been in lots of stuff.
Oh, he was in another movie with Matthew Broderick. How about that?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's your connection there. And Ken Hutchinson, he was in Straw Dogs and Gandhi, so he was Marquette, another guy with some good resume. And, of course, went on to a pretty good career, Alfred Molina.
I know.
And again, if that name doesn't sound familiar, he was Doc Ock in Spider-Man 2.
Yeah.
He was in Raiders of the Lost Ark, The Da Vinci Code, and again, Chocolat. So.
Yeah, and he's, like, I remember I was watching this just the other day, and I was looking at him like, holy crap, I forgot Alfred Molina's in this movie.
You know, it's
another
surprising.
Another ageless actor. He looks exactly the same in 1985 as he did in Spider-Man. I'm sorry, but he just did not age at all.
And I don't think this is one movie where you get sort of a sense of, like, he's a larger man, but I never think of him that way. He's a large, imposing guy, but it's only really in this movie they play it up as much, to me.
It's true.
Well, Richard Donner did use him in that kind of big, heavy character in Maverick as well, right?
Oh, I don't remember.
It's funny how much I had actually seen Alfred Molina since the 80s, not really realizing he was in all these movies. Like, when I was putting this together, and I'm like, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and then I'm like, it just popped in my head. I'm like, yep, he was. I could totally see that scene in my head. So, he's just one of those guys. He's been around so long, but you didn't realize how long he'd been in the game.
Oh, for sure.
No, for sure. Absolutely. I mean, every time I see his name in credits, I'm like, oh, cool, Alfred Molina. But I never actually sort of remember it after I've watched it. It's really odd. He's one of those. He's not forgettable, but you forget that he's in movies.
He's one of those actors who's like that guy. You know that guy from The Thing? Like, you know him.
I don't even see it that way. I think when he's in a movie, like, I see his character. I don't see Alfred Molina.
I think that's exactly it.
And that's the sign of a really good actor. If you could make me forget you're in it and just remember the character. And, yeah, that's why I like Alfred Molina, man.
Hmm. And he's good. So good.
Totally. So, Lady Hawk, this is fantasy romance piece, I guess?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you'd put it in that action fantasy, but there's not a lot of action, honestly.
Oh, no, I don't... We're not even about the action. Oh, we're going to talk about the action.
Yeah. No.
Or lack thereof.
This movie is 2 hours long. It is so long. Why is it 2 hours long? There's not enough plot driving it for 2 hours.
Because Donner got
now
a little
you know how I felt
indulgent
about the fucking Hobbit.
Yes, he spent a lot of time with pretty, pretty shots.
And yeah, well, I guess that's, again, The Hobbit, but that is definitely the strengths of this movie is, my God, all the shots are beautifully composed. The locations are immaculately presented. Everything feels very period until the actors show up.
with
their 80s hair and
there's definitely some of that.
The costumes are pretty good too. Everything looks fairly period.
It looks dirty,
except
and
for
mucky.
Those stupid helmets near the end of the movie.
Yeah, I didn't get those.
Ridiculous looking, but
they look like something.
And the swords were so shiny.
Yeah.
Oh, well, we'll take care of
them. They look shiny and aluminum.
Yes, they did not look authentic. That's the only thing. That and the helmets were the only thing that did not look authentic to me.
Well, I was popped right out of the movie when I saw the Dr. Pepper logo, so. That's a joke.
Oh, okay.
That's a joke.
I was like going, what?
She should have seen the look she was giving me.
Okay, I was a little under the weather when I was watching this, so I was heavily medicated, which is why I'm a little confused, and sometimes you could probably get some of this shit past me.
Well, that could confuse the comedian. Oh, my God.
Well, you got me too, Jay. I'm like, how did I miss that?
Jesus. I guess I was a little too subtle after you said aluminum, but.
Yeah. Yes.
The swords were made of aluminum.
Yeah
they were just terrible. I'm sorry.
They
didn't look like that age where it wasn't. You didn't have those metals so refined.
Yeah, well, you see the size of Rucker Hauer's sword, the Navari sword, and it's massive. That's a broadsword.
He's
one-handing it a lot.
Yeah.
Like, it's a broadsword. It's a big-ass sword, which means you're probably right. It was aluminum or something similar, because there's no way you'd be throwing that thing around if it was made what it was supposed to be made of.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And, I mean, they looked like they had been cast and polished and quite possibly even electroplated to be shiny, so they would look good on camera.
Yeah, and there's certain points, too, where it just seems so inauthentic. Like, when Matthew Broderick's using it to cut wood, I'm like, that sword's not going to look nice after that.
No, it was funny, but inauthentic, yes. That Rucker Hauer's reaction at the end of that scene, though, was probably the best acting he did in the whole movie.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was that bad.
Well, they originally wanted him as the villain.
Yeah.
Either Marquette or Bishop, I can't remember.
I think he was supposed to be the Bishop.
Yeah, and he didn't want to play. I think that was when he was moving into the heroic action movies, and he wanted to kind of cultivate those roles a bit and didn't want to be stereotyped as a bad guy because, you know, Blade Runner, and he'd already done a few bad guy roles.
Yeah, Blade Runner, Nighthawks.
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
yeah, which you can see.
Really iconic bad guys, too. So definitely I can see him wanting to move away from that and not be yet another bad guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have that whole, his IMDb is just, he's on the listings of all the best bad guys.
Yeah. Well,
forever.
What was the other fantasy movie around this? Was that Flesh and Blood?
Oh, he did that one.
I think that was Flesh and Blood. And I remember that being really terrible too. And I'm like, dude, no more fantasy movies.
Well, I mean, Blade Runner, like, it sort of depends which point of fantasy, medieval fantasy. Yeah.
That's sci-fi. I'm fine with sci-fi. He's okay for sci-fi.
Yeah, he has the right look for sci-fi, but there's something, and it's just like the fantasy dialogue just doesn't work for him because, I mean, English is his second or third or sixth language or something like that.
Yeah, because he's Danish, I believe.
Danish or Finnish, something like that. But definitely English is not his first language, and I think that in the science fiction roles, that sort of stilted, very stiff delivery worked really well for him.
Mm-hmm.
But in the fantasy roles, not so much, at least not early in his career. I don't think he developed
enough as an actor at that point for such a heavy lead role. When you're playing a replicant robot, fine, because that kind of works. But I felt like it was a very similar delivery in a lot of respects. Like, nothing phases me. Nothing phased him in this whole movie. a lot.
No. And, I mean, we'd already seen that he was capable of a range. I mean, I don't know if either of you have ever seen The Austin Weekend, which is a really great movie. And, I mean, he's got quite a significant role in that movie, and he was really good so maybe, you know what, maybe he just didn't really want to do the movie, and it was, as we keep going back to, a paycheck movie.
It could be,
but you're saying it might have been just sort of a misinterpretation of, like, I think Navarre, the role of Navarre, he's supposed to be kind of this you know, stoic. he's pissed off because everything that's happened. But I think maybe he misinterpreted that as to be more stoic rather than to actually.
Yeah, because he rarely actually even seems pissed off. And occasionally he gets these looks of minor annoyance, and then he's, yeah. For a guy who's like, had his love ripped away from him and they can't be together, they've been cursed. One is turns into this hawk during the day, and he turns into a wolf at night. There's your catch. Mm-hmm. And that's
which is
curse.
Really the plot of the movie.
And is and they've been cursed by the bishop, who is in love with Isabeau.
Isabeau. Love that name. But yeah, it's sort of, I think he was more world weary than he was angry. And that kind of...
It did seem weary, yeah.
It didn't seem to be as much as, like, he seemed defeated.
Well, the thing is, I felt like the world wasn't even giving him much of a challenge. Like, there'd be, like, 5-6 guys he'd beat almost like he was bored.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he was the captain of the guard. I think he was the best of the best.
Yeah.
And people knew that. And they could have capitalized on that.
Yeah. And interestingly, I don't think they did enough of this throughout the movie. And I think was that very first fight sequence where he rescues Mouse from the guard.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the guards sees the captain. And,
yes.
And he's like, oh, you're back, captain. And he was so thrilled.
Yeah.
That he had a loyalty from the guard that they could have played on a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of making them just these sort of thugs, bad guys, they could have shown those divided loyalties a lot better.
Yeah, mm-hmm. There could have been a whole like undercurrent of people in the guard who were looking to help Navarre, or remembered him, or felt that maybe this whole thing was becoming more corrupt.
Yeah, and the only time it resurfaces is at the end of the movie again, right?
Yes. Yeah.
All right, well, we're getting deep into this now. I'm going to run the trailer so you guys can kind of catch up a little bit if you guys haven't already watched the movie. We always assume you guys do. We got a smart crowd out there. Mm-hmm. They see the movie. I'm like, oh, okay. Save the podcast for 2 hours after you downloaded it because I need to watch this movie.
And to be fair, this was like 30 years ago. So if you haven't seen it by now, that's really not on us.
I don't carry spoiler warnings on this show because tough.
Yeah, and when, if all those fails, maybe we make fair. You want to watch it, even if you haven't seen it before.
Yeah,
yeah. And after all, this is the remake show, and we're here to give people good ideas. Because this movie, you know, some people love
There's
it, some people don't.
It.
There's something there, and I do feel like it has kind of been forgotten, especially considering the big stars that were in this at the time. But anyway, here's the trailer.
Was a pickpocket. Thought that anything was better than prison. Little did he know what he'd escaped from wasn't half as strange or frightening as what he'd stumbled into.
I do not believe what I believe, Lord. These are magical, unexplainable matters, and I beg you not to make me a part of them.
The knight who had saved him wanted only two things. To free his lover and to take his revenge.
I have waited almost 2 years for a sign from God.
Sir, the truth is I talk to God all the time. And no offense, but he never mentioned you.
The pickpocket was the key to his plan. But would you send a thief to guard your treasure? He was the last one in the world to act like a hero. It just happened. By itself. And he was drawn into a magical, romantic adventure. Matthew Broderick. Michelle Pfeiffer. Rutger Hauer. Lady Hawk.
There you have it. Some more of that terrible music. Sorry, I do apologize, but I didn't make it. It just exists. And you will be well rewarded near the end. There is an artist who obviously liked this movie because she took it as her name. She's a musician from New Zealand, and I'm going to play a little bit of that near the end. So stay tuned for Lady Hawk. Mm-hmm. You dig it, go support her. All right, so let's get into this, the meat of this thing. Film opens with Mouse as he's escaping from a death sentence.
Like, yeah.
They are coming to take him to the...
This is a medieval prison.
Gallows. It was gallows.
It was gallows, yeah.
And they're asking for him specifically. It wasn't random. They wanted him. And they never make it clear what the motivation was. They wanted him so badly.
Mm-hmm. I would like to have been more hinted to that Mouse had stolen something sort of incriminating. I would like to believe that maybe the bishop has it in for Mouse for more personal reasons.
And I think that they wanted you to feel that, but they didn't convey it very well.
No.
No, and hey, there's something you've introduced into our remake right away.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, maybe even just a short sequence showing how he ended up in the dungeons.
Yeah.
Without even necessarily telling you what it is he found. That could come out later.
Or have something that he, or somebody returning something to the bishop, and like, we've got it, and we've got the guy, mm-hmm. here it is. He's going to the gallows tomorrow or something.
I feel like a lot of the motivations are weak. Like, the curse, the explanation for the curse just happens in two pieces of dialogue. One from Imperius and a short acknowledgement from the bishop, but
I don't know. The bishop is mentally unhinged. A psychopath making them cursed doesn't really. Sure, it seems. I think it's a perfectly reasonable motivation. He's a nutcase.
Oh, I'm not saying the motivation's bad. It just is not well defined. Like, you're dealing with with demons, and like, fuck on, I don't want to see that. There's magic in this world, and we're not really seeing it.
Yeah, that would be nice to get some more clarification on how he did that, but like, the whole point of, if I can't have her, nobody can, that seems exactly what he would do.
Based on his portrayal of the character, for sure, he was selfish, egotistical,
and corrupt.
I mean, I love that line where he says, the peasants complain when we tax them more. I can't even remember.
Yeah, he's
line.
Like, and then there's nothing left to tax.
Yes.
And I'm like going, yeah, this guy's, he's crazy. But mm-hmm. I mean, this is the whole thing. Like, he's totally leaning into the fact, like, oh, I've got the church behind me, so I can do whatever the fuck I want. Like, he has no, there's nothing there except this corruption.
Yeah. Did anybody wonder where the kings and queens of this land were, or if this was just a land run by the church?
I don't know. I think it was like hinted.
I kept wondering about that.
No, it's a legitimate question, actually.
I mean, I feel there should have been maybe some royalty, but the other point of it, too, is like, you could have it where the bishop does control everything.
Yeah.
I mean, at that point, like, I mean, you have like the papacy, the Rome was ruling a lot of stuff, like just through the Catholic Church.
You mentioned, Jay, that the time period was, they sort of suggested that it was shortly after the time of the Black Death. So the church was very powerful and prominent at that time. If my memory of history is correct.
Yes.
Is they took a lot of power because of the fear of this disease, and it was all they treated it as a very religious thing rather than as now, mm-hmm. a virus that's carried by rats and fleas. But fleas. But
More recently they say hamsters and guinea pigs also would be things that would have carried the Black Plague.
Yeah, well, so I mean, that would have been
anything that has fleas, right?
Mm-hmm.
1300s, something like that, mid 1300s. Yeah. So. That's been theorized. That was something, a fact I kind of found, but nothing I've seen on paper stating. And they are trying to be vague about it. It's this fantasy world.
Well, I think also the other reason to do it is there's no royalty that has any point in the story, really. Like, there's no reason to put any royalty in because they aren't part of this whole thing.
Oh, not this current version, no.
No, but I mean, in a remake, certainly you could fit the Duke or Duchess of Aquila in there,
mm-hmm.
and have him completely subjugated by the bishop.
I feel like everybody needs a little bit more to do in this movie. It just feels like this is their one thing. You know, Rutger Hauer wants his revenge, mm-hmm. wants the curse to end. Mouse really is just trying to get away from everything, and they keep dragging him back. The bishop is just, I almost feel like I need to see more of it rather than him telling me he's attacking the shit out of people. We don't even see a lot of the people, really, and maybe that's how they, you know, they're paying a lot for the locations rather than people.
I wonder where the budget went, and it's like, well, sets, locations.
Yeah.
I mean, costumes. Yeah, you're doing it at real castles, like real places.
But, you know, I'd like to see him maybe subjugating the people or at least
the effects of what he's doing on the people.
Yeah, or at least maybe he's embezzling from the king, like just that greed. I don't know. Like, I need to know the motivations of why he's doing what he's doing. And I don't feel like there's really anything other than just an asshole
this is
bishop.
What I can't quite understand. Like, you know what the motivations to do something. If a person's a piece of shit, motivations to be more of a piece of shit don't matter. this guy, he's just like, greed seems to is an actual reasonable motivation for anything.
Yeah, but we don't maniacal see enough power of anything. And greed. It's all just handled in dialogue, and that's what ticks me off.
Well, oh, yeah, just no, you can show it, but like, I'm saying,
and nobody's really doing much.
Well, I will say this: when I saw this movie when I was a teenager, I could not finish watching it.
Yeah, well, it took me. I took a shower in the middle of it yesterday. Yeah.
No,
I loved it.
I was a
and maybe that's just it. Teenage boy. Maybe was this wasn't fun. Meant for us because it
I don't think it is.
At the heart of it, it is a romance movie.
This is for girls. This is for young girls. This is what this movie was. A doomed romance was what really got me into
it. I think they were trying for the ultimate date movie and didn't quite get there. Because they had a little bit for the guys and a little bit for girls or women, but they didn't quite get there with either.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Even as the romance goes, I didn't feel any of it. You know, I didn't.
Well, they had a unique challenge, right? You're trying to show a romance when you can't get your two leads together. Exactly, and I think that in the end they handled that spectacularly well. Mm-hmm. I think that they hadn't handled that ongoing love affair between the two characters. Just the way they dealt with each other as their animal counterparts was really
that's true.
Really
they
well
even
handled.
Do talk about some of the conflict they have and some of that doubt, and then it just goes out of their voices. And at least with Michelle Pfeiffer, anyway.
Well, part of it was also to use Mouse as that bridge
sounding
between
board.
Them.
Yes. Yeah, but he was creating stuff out of whole cloth, and that was awesome.
Yeah,
I want to. I'd like to talk about Mouse because I know that Jay doesn't really like Matthew Broderick, and. Probably didn't even really like Mouse, but I saw a lot of Ferris Bueller in this character.
Me too. And that was the problem.
But what I loved was his conversations with God, and they talk about that in a lot of the articles and reviews that I did read as well. But it was this dialogue he had with himself. You could see that the person that he wanted to be versus the person he was. I mean, he was kind of smart alecky, kind of innocent, very faithful to God.
Yeah. Right?
And I think that's...
He's a religious person, but he's perfectly fine with his own flaws.
Exactly. He's got his own sort of set of moral standards.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I love the line where he makes that promise to God and then he promptly breaks it and says, you knew I wasn't going to keep it. You know who I am.
Yeah, he's like, you know how weak I am. You made me. Like, it's kind of like, yeah, that's kind of reasonable.
Yes, no, and I mean, I really enjoyed Mouse all the way throughout the movie. I think... Of all the acting, his was the best.
Yeah, or he talks to Navarre. He's like, I talk to God all the time, and he's never mentioned you.
Yeah, for me, Broderick, he just doesn't feel of the time for me. Like you said, you see a lot of Ferris Bueller in the character, and that was my big problem, is so did I.
Yes, and I mean, you could see the makings of Ferris Bueller in there, and it wasn't so close that I wasn't able to separate them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I felt like here's this 80s guy playing cosplay. Like, I didn't feel like he fit in the time period. And it is like this American kid in Europe. I don't know, it was probably the same problem I would have had with Robin Hood when Costner's not putting on an accent either. But I don't know, everything felt, even though his conversations with God and stuff, like, I felt like the stuff with the character was there. He just wasn't right for that character. Sometimes I just wanted him to shut the fuck up.
But I think that was part of his whole character. Like, the thing is, he talks to God a lot because he has nobody else to talk to.
Well,
so he
right,
does
I mean,
do
he
that.
Is, he's alone, right? I mean, his character is very.
Yeah,
alone.
Well,
it
takes about 15 minutes for him to before Rutger Hauer even shows up.
Sure,
yeah.
And that's just it. I feel like he could. Could have somebody, should have somebody more to play off of. Like, Rutger Hauer should be there earlier on. And it's weird. Like, he'll be talking to himself when trying to stealthily escape from people.
Yes, no.
I'm like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, wait until you're out of earshot at least.
It's true. But I mean, think of it this way. When you're watching a scene of somebody quietly doing something for 10 minutes, you're going to be bored. I think you're going to be bored.
He wasn't quietly doing something for 10 minutes. He was. He couldn't keep his mouth shut for 5 seconds.
No, no. But think about it. If you're watching something and it's 10 minutes of silence where you're watching them just go through a tunnel.
Yeah, but that's not what I'm fucking saying. It was literally talking all the fucking time.
I know,
like,
and I'm
if you're trying to get away from people in a sewer grate and there's guys standing on your fucking fingers right up top, nobody's. I swear, everybody in Aquila is fucking deaf.
Especially when he screamed after his fingers got stepped on. And yeah, there's a few flaws in there, but
yeah, like they just. But I'm telling you, in terms of script, they don't make sense. They don't even make sense in the script. Like, fine, when he's off going escaping to the town, or he's in the bowels of the sewers and nobody's around, sure, then it's fine to have him talk to himself, whatever. Because yeah, that would be boring. But yeah, in scenes where he should be fucking quiet, he can't even stay quiet. It just drives, it drove me nuts.
Well, and I think that was supposed to be what the way you felt about him, actually, is he was, because he was irreverent and he was a motor mouth. He never, I mean, he was supposed to be that character because he was lonely, right? I mean, he talks to himself because there's nobody else to talk to.
I felt like, I'm like, oh God, he's going to just break the fourth wall any second here. Like he's medieval. I mean, he's a fucking medieval Deadpool.
I think maybe it was a little overdone, but I still thoroughly enjoyed it. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, that was the best part of the movie because he never ceased to be entertaining.
His constant bargaining with God is quite interesting, where he talks about, I told the truth, Lord. How do you expect me to learn anything if you keep confusing me like this? Like, he's talking to God all the time. I liked it. I
was fine with that dialogue. I really think that's
what this whole thing is. If it was somebody else.
You don't have to think it. I said it in the first opening 5 minutes.
I know, but when you're talking about the character of Mouse, I don't think you've separated the two. I think you're I hate listening to Matthew Broderick.
No, there
are times where it's inappropriate.
There are scenes, it's just the character isn't well written at times. And it is what it is. Yeah. Like, sometimes the character and the situations are doing different things.
Yeah, I mean, I liked the commentary with the, and that, again, that first scene where the guard catches him, where he offers to buy drinks for everybody. And
I honestly feel like if he did break the fourth wall, I would have been on board with it a bit. You know, if he started talking to the camera a little bit, like somebody was actually there with him.
And you know what? There you go. That's Ferris Bueller 100% because that's...
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't even make that connection in my brain because I don't like that movie either. Now that I think about it, that was the next step for him, so...
Yeah, was acknowledging his audience.
Yeah.
But there are times where maybe he could have been...
Makes me wonder how much of that was actually in the script. I'd love to see the script and see maybe if there was a ton of ad-libbing going on with Broderick, because he's not playing off anybody.
No, he's...
And he does have a gift for delivery. You know, I've seen him in movies I like, and the stage work is... I mean, nobody can argue with the stage work.
I think... But I don't know. I think the talking to God is part of it, because of the whole... kind of church and where it falls within the narrative of the story.
Yeah, I wouldn't take that out. I mean, the religion plays a heavy part in this. And in fact, I'd play up a little bit more, because here's the bishop not doing godly things.
Oh, no.
And going, really subverting the message to his own needs. And here's a guy who's conflicted with his relationship with God and the way the world works. And hell, you could even add to that with, if you acknowledge the time period post Black Plague. Mm-hmm. You know, I can see where this conflict with God might take place.
Yeah, and then if you got Imperius, who's another conflicted religious figure, right? I mean, he's an alcoholic, and he's conflicted about the fact that he broke his vow of the confessional.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Right? So there's a lot of opportunity to bring some religious...
I really liked Imperius.
Yeah, he's looking to break the curse because he feels that's his redemption, not anything else.
Yeah.
Is the breaking
Despite the fact it was just loose lips sink ships kind of thing, he feels responsible for it, but he's not the one who did it.
No, he wasn't, but he felt if he hadn't have said anything, would the bishop have done this? And he thinks no.
Right, which I think is false guilt, because I mean,
sure,
you can't keep a relationship secret anywhere.
Oh, true. Right? But I mean, he feels
ultimately they would have been found out. But you needed that foil, right? You needed that person who carries the guilt of his actions.
And
he put it on medieval Twitter.
Yeah, and to be fair, he carried that guilt. But when he, in doing so, he sought a solution.
Yes.
If he didn't carry that guilt for it, he never would have.
Yeah, he spent the 2 or 3 years at the, since the
two
curse,
years,
searching for a way to break the curse.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, I mean, yeah, he was absolutely looking for redemption. He's the only one in the whole movie who's actually looking for redemption.
Yeah, Rutger Hauer, I mean, he wanted the curse lifted, but he didn't know how. He just he would have just settled for the bishop's death, which would have made that curse go on until I don't know. I don't know if those they would have been immortal birds and wolves or not.
I know that would have been nice. No, I seem to think they would have. I don't know why.
I don't know. Yeah, I feel like that would be part of the curse. I'm like, you're never going to die. And be together.
I feel it was like the curse is that shitty that is what it would do.
Yeah, that would be horrible.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, this is not a nice curse.
No, it's not a nice curse, right? But, I mean, at the same time, I mean, it was beautifully handled at the end where they talk about where night and day are the same.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. With the eclipse.
Yeah.
I think that was really nicely handled. But I'm getting ahead of myself, or us, because we're nowhere near that point. But
we can jump around.
We can jump around, yeah. It's
For this two-hour movie, like, I found...
There's not a lot of meat.
Like, I... felt like, oh god, this, I mean, easily could have shaved half an hour out of this movie.
For sure. Like I said, there's a lot of...
These characters definitely needed more to do. They kept drifting off and wandering back together.
There's too many interactions with the guards where Navarre just kind of gets away, and there's, like, at least one of the guards always escapes, and this never really gets back to the bishop somehow.
Yeah.
And the bishop is never really thinking about it.
If the bishop was fucking Darth Vader and he didn't take bad news well, then I'd understand why they never showed up and told him anything. Yeah. But
like he's trying to find he has this one guy out hunting wolves all the time.
Yeah, Cesar, yeah.
Cesar.
And he doesn't get introduced until well into the second act.
And really, he's not in it very much
at all. He's like the last...
No.
And when he finally shows up, they're kind of just standing around until he falls over into his own trap. Like, what is going on here? He's not even really being threatening. They're all just kind of standing around talking.
Well, and that's probably my biggest complaint about the movie is you've got Richard Donner's director who, I mean, let's face it, has directed some of the best action films of the time. And the action when it occurs is really terrible.
Yeah, when I feel like the moment demands something to happen, nothing really does. Yeah.
And even when it does, it's poorly choreographed. It looks awkward.
Yeah.
Right? Like it just did not look
good. I think
good.
It's because Richard Donner can't do as many explosions as he could have normally.
Yeah, he didn't hire the right swords master to...
Because this is medieval, so you can't do a lot of explosions.
No.
So a lot of other stuff has to happen.
Yeah, like, I don't know. I mean, if you wanted this to be the date movie, there should have been something there for the guys.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm okay with violence in a romance. I mean, the lovers who can't be together, I'm like, that drives the film just fine, but... You do need other things to get to that climactic moment where that curse is broken. And there's not a lot. Like, even when they're trying to trap Navarre in his wolf form, and that scene just awkwardly goes nowhere.
Yeah.
Navarre falls in the ice, and then they go rescue him, and even that doesn't feel all that threatening. I didn't feel any tension in that scene.
Right. I mean, I love that scene.
Yeah.
After, like, when he after he falls into the ice and what it leads to
morning. That was,
again, really well done. Like, there's all these moments that were really, really great in the movie.
Yeah, like them hiding the sword after the rescue. Really poorly. And,
yeah.
You know, there's some neat nuggets here, but nothing. Yeah, all these great threads that either don't get developed enough or just kind of get left lying on the side of the road.
Part of it is
there's a lot of the movie is the travel from one point to another, which is weird because I don't know when you kind of catch when Navarre and Philippe the mouse get together, they're traveling for a long time to get back to Aquila, but I don't believe that Philippe got that far away.
No. I don't think he got that far away either.
And then with Imperius...
Did they just wander the other direction and then circle around?
Yeah. Like, I mean, and with Imperius, he leaves with Navarre earlier, and then Imperius kind of follows them later, and it's like they kind of should have been traveling together. I don't know if you really, but it's sort of... There's a lot of different bits of travel with a bunch of different people.
Yeah, and I don't think they ever left Aquila or whatever, so... You know, it's always the bishop's guards that they're
in conflict
with.
So you can shorten
with.
The trip, and I feel you get rid of at least one of the interactions with the guards.
Yeah.
Keep the one where she gets shot.
Yeah, keep the one where she gets shot for sure. Really two like really big ones. There's the one where she gets shot, and the first one with.
That was an accidental scene too. Like, you know, they weren't aiming for her. The crossbow.
Yeah.
It was arrow. A device. It was a device to get Imperius introduced.
Yeah, get Imperius introduced and to clarify so that Matthew brought, like, the mouse knows completely and for sure this time that the woman and the hawk are
I know
the
same. Why that guy didn't go back, because the guards were told specifically not to harm the hawk. So that's why that guy, he's probably still walking.
he's hiding somewhere. He's training to be a blacksmith somewhere in some small town.
They're like, the one thing they told me not to do. You had one job.
Yeah, you're like going to kill the wolf but keep the hawk. I mean, really? Can you keep it straight?
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head with that one. Yeah, he was told, they were told not to hurt the hawk, and she got hurt.
The guys that survived that scene, they're like, would you go back? No. I wouldn't go back either. No.
And it would be even better if we had that divided loyalties thing that we were talking about earlier, right?
Yeah.
Because then it's like, well, I'm really not going back now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Or at least have them going like Navarre, like, don't go back. He's got it in for you.
Speaking of, that final scene, and everybody's just standing around, you know, these guys have gone to mass at this church, and... I mean, at least with the people of Aquila, I can see why they wouldn't get involved. But there wasn't even the guards started kind of cheering for him after the bishop was killed. So
see, and I think that's where that they didn't really clarify that divided loyalties.
Didn't, no,
show how heavy-handed and this bishop really was.
No,
right? His motivations aren't in question. It's his actions don't.
Yeah. Really, and he's a fine actor in his scenes.
I think it's sort of, it's weird. You should have the divided loyalties, but the problem with that is that he's a bishop. And to, like, defy him is literally to defy the church. So people aren't willing to do that, but they kind of have to do it in an underhanded way by just letting Navarre through.
Yes, and that's exactly
that. You cannot openly defy Catholic Church.
You know, Navarre was the former captain of the guard before... You know, this all happened and was forced to leave. So a lot of them are still, you know, happy to see him. And he's obviously good at his job. And I think maybe we should have seen a little bit more of that.
Yeah, I think he was fairly well loved. And I think that's...
And as well, the new guy, I don't think people liked him.
No, yeah, Marquette? No, I don't think people liked Marquette at all.
They didn't really... Again, they didn't develop sort of your key villains or your key heroes very well. I mean, the only character who got any development was Mouse.
You know, and Imperius a bit.
I'd bump up Marquette, and he's the military advisor to the king. We don't have to see the king, but he's representing the king in all this.
No, he's a total sheriff of Nottingham.
Yeah, I would. I mean, that's just it. That's how I felt the bishop was the sheriff. But I would totally make Marquette that. The bishop isn't knocking on doors saying, give me money. That's Marquette. Should be Marquette.
No, and it should be Marquette, exactly. Yeah. Right? I mean, I think that Marquette was the sheriff of Nottingham, to put in sort of references. And then the bishop was the prince. Prince John, was it?
Yeah. I think so, yeah.
Yeah, Prince John, right?
Those parables are certainly seen in this.
Yeah. Sure. And I remember
he was a snake in the cartoon.
Yes. Yeah, just not very well developed. We keep going back to that. It's like Donner really wanted to do the really, really, really pretty shots and forgot that there are people in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's...
I mean, maybe that's just to deflect from a weak script. I don't know.
But the script wasn't really that weak.
No, you can put more... You could make it meatier.
This was a decent scriptwriter, so...
Yeah. But yeah, there's a lot of shots of them traveling. I think that's the thing. Yeah. There's a beautiful scenery in this movie.
And huge panoramic shots. Scenery. And they were gorgeous. No question. They were absolutely gorgeous.
I think maybe, unlike The Hobbit, where you do feel...
Bored?
I don't know. I wasn't bored through that because I liked the characters going in, and I wasn't attached to anybody in this, so I didn't care where they were going.
See, I was attached.
You know, you can have an interesting scene and scenery at the same time.
Oh, you can.
And I felt like maybe that was kind of this movie. They weren't doing it at the same time.
I think they could have made better use of the night. They have a lot of great scenery shots during the day. They could have made lots more use of the night and time with Isabeau. mm-hmm. to like really kind of you can get that beauty without mm-hmm. you know.
And I guess they were anything. Probably a bit limited because they were using actual animals Ooh. On these sets to do all these practical shots. So training, I don't know. I don't think they had overly well trained animals, so they were probably limited in what they could do in those scenes. Because I certainly would have. Like to had a little bit more going on with them, even as animals.
So. Yeah, that would have made it certainly a lot more. Yeah.
I did like that opening battle where, you know, they're after Mouse and he uses the hawk to distract the guards. Well, yeah. you know, that was kind of cool.
Yeah,
because like, it shows that they have a relationship, even though they can't be together. They still have this very symbiotic
this
relationship. Yeah,
but we don't see too of much something. Of that afterwards. We don't see much more of that. After that scene.
No, like most of the stuff, when we're talking about like scenery, you see with Navarre, there's not a lot of development, but there's lots of beautiful scenery because he's during the day and you have the hawk. In the nighttime, I found I got to know Isabeau a bit more because you were filming at night and you have to have your characters talk because you can't do those great sweeping shots. Mm-hmm. So I feel there's more character development during the night is what happened.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. there's a certain logic to that. You're absolutely right.
Well, that's true. I mean, it's not like that Navarre was doing a lot of sharing in his scenes.
No,
so.
No. He, I mean, to be fair, Navarre did not have a lot of dialogue.
No, but he wanted to keep Mouse around for, I don't know, I think because, more for her than him.
No, he wanted to keep Mouse around because Mouse could get him into the cathedral.
Yeah, yeah, well, that's true. He escaped.
I think
that was his
initial plan, but the more he kind of had Mouse around and how Mouse would talk to him about the time he spent with Isabeau, he became more valuable to Navarre.
Yeah, his function changed. I actually, that scene where it's not a very good scene, but when Navarre gets jealous mm-hmm. of his time with Isabeau.
Yeah.
And yeah, or the Isabeau as Hawk goes to Matthew Broderick rather than Navarre.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like, what?
What just happened? Yeah, and that was a fun scene, but it's not one that I felt Rutger Hauer pulled off to great effect. You know, I felt that was a scene that might have gone a little longer, and he didn't deliver that comedy on the humor that scene delivers.
Mm-hmm.
It's there, but it's all pretty much on Broderick's shoulders.
All the comedy in this movie is on Broderick's shoulders. Like,
and that was the one opportunity.
And to an extent, Imperius here and there.
Here and there, Imperius. But
and Imperius starts off...
comically.
Bit. No, he doesn't. I think he starts off seriously, becomes comical.
Oh, see, because at the very start, when you first meet him... He's like, hello. He's like, hi, I have a hawk here. Oh, good shot. We shall dine together. He's like, we can't eat this hawk. Oh, is it Lent already? Like, he's not.
Okay, fair.
That's his first few lines. And then he becomes super serious, realizing who the hawk is.
He's a big, boisterous soul.
I love his voice.
Yes. He has a great voice. It was perfect for that role.
Yeah. That would have upped him and maybe introduced him a bit earlier, but.
Yeah. But to be fair, having him in isolation and in his own self-imposed exile kind of made sense.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think really it took too long to get to...
Imperius.
Everything.
Everybody.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Like you're saying, there's a lot of travel and a lot of sweeping shots.
Yeah, even Moses' escape from
I'm
the
not
dungeon
even sure
was
that's
too long.
The, like, I don't think those big scenes of scenery are long or anything else. Like... There's a lot of them, but they're fairly quick when they happen. It's just it takes so long in the scenes that they're in, but while not saying very much in those scenes.
Yeah, when you put a lot of them together, it does make up a lot.
Yeah, but screen time it's not a ton. It's just every sequence in the film takes so long to say nothing. You know, even the action scenes of like, okay, we're going to have some conflict, but there's not really much conflict and there's more talking but they're not saying anything. Not a lot of it drives the plot. It just continues.
Well, no, because it's not meant to drive the plot. It's meant to drive the relationships.
Yeah.
But most of the time, I wasn't even doing that.
Well, no, I mean, any scene with Navarre and Mouse, you're right. It didn't really drive the relationship. Yeah. Any time that Isabeau was on the screen,
mm-hmm.
and
which
isn't much, you're right.
No,
but that scene.
But I felt
where,
I know her better.
Yeah,
because there's
a scene where they go where they dance with each other, which was an excellent scene.
Yeah, and I would probably done a little bit more of that.
Yeah,
or when she's trying to hunt like the rabbit, or at one point when he catches up with her and she's like, I got my knife. Where did I put my knife? What did I do with it? And he's like, I think we can break the curse. Mm-hmm. Like there's, I got to know her better simply because.
Yeah. I mean, we need to know why Navarre, I mean, we know because they kind of just tell us in dialogue, but I want to see why he's so distant. I want to see him be more distant with Mouse trying to engage him. You know, yeah. I want to see those deliberate moments of him being just, you know, you're going to get me in. That's what you're here to do. Yeah.
But I also want to see more of his anger. Like if Mouse even pushes him on, like, you're going to, you know, like there's a few scenes where they kind of do it where he says, look, I think we can break. And he's like, you'll never mention that again. And then they stop. Mm-hmm. I would like it more antagonistic where like he needles it where he's like, you don't understand anything you're talking about. Like just get Navarre.
Well, I mean, he changed him to a tree because he feels like Mouse is going to run away on
him. Oh, yeah. Yes. But I mean, that doesn't really explain his rage.
I don't feel like he's even being, he's like, eh. You know, he gets out and he's like, eh, all right.
Yeah, there's no, well, you know, very rarely do you actually even get this a sense of rage. It's just this determination that you get.
See, and I would like the rage.
No, I agree. I agree that there needs to be a simmering anger under that character rather than just that plotting determination. And that's the flaw in Navarre, as played by Rutger Hauer, is it wasn't there. He wasn't angry. He was just determined.
Yeah, I didn't even,
you know, and like, a little just, weary.
Yeah, I didn't. He was feel tired. Like he was. I don't know, like.
It's just this, you know, thing when you watch, has to do.
Yeah, it's just this, yeah, the thing he has to do. You know, with Hitcher, like, I felt like there was something haunting that character when he was playing that in that classic horror movie. Mm-hmm. But just never got captured again. There's just that something in that weariness of that character. And I felt like he was trying to bring the same thing to this character, but that's not what the character demanded. So no. Maybe that's just part of his acting style. Well, the character style.
Should be haunted, but it doesn't. I didn't quite get. I feel it'd be haunted, but like angry about the situation. But like, I think there should be something like a little less contained about it.
Yeah, well, the most of the time, I just felt the worst emotion he felt was irritation.
Yeah, no, exactly.
He just seems sad and weary,
and then he'd give you that wry smile right after that irritation. Yeah. It's like, oh, whatever, water under the bridge.
No, I mean, there's the scene with the sword where I think you mentioned it earlier, Trish. Is the scene where he's cutting where Mouse is cutting the wood with Navarre's sword. And then there's this really, actually, what is actually a really beautiful story about the jewels on the sword.
Yeah, I did like that.
Right? And then and the sword has importance later in the film.
And this is family sword.
Yeah, it's the family sword. And then, of course, when they lead them to believe that it's been lost. Mm-hmm. Right? But that's would have been a great place to show how angry and frustrated he really is with his situation. Mm-hmm. Right? Because telling the story and how he's never going to fill that stone. Right, he's never going to complete his big quest because he has this other job to do because somebody else has stepped into his life and ruined it.
Yeah, it's his other quest.
Yeah, right. So, and I think that would have been a great place to really develop that character.
Yeah, they give us this really great moment with him and this moment of almost pride in his family and what he needs to do as a member of this family and to carry on this tradition with this sword. And
it's been taken away with him, along with his
bow. And then we
never get it again.
Yeah.
With the jewels, like when he's like, you have to go on a quest. Is the quest to get a jewel, or what is?
Well, I mean,
it's a representation of the task.
Yeah,
I guess. So you just find one and put one in there.
Yeah, it's a symbol of the accomplishment.
Yeah, you have to earn the right to place the stone in.
Yeah.
Right? That chance to do that was taken away from him by the bishop, and as was Isabeau. So all the things that gave his life purpose have been taken away from him.
Yeah, and that's a strong thing. Like, if you're going to do a date movie, like, things people respond to, women and men in these type of movies, that we find men like things like honor and pride and things like that in their leading characters. And that's the kind of thing that kind of makes me a little teary-eyed. And I'm like, okay, that's kind of cool. Let's go with that.
Hit it on the head, because I'm like, I don't get it. No, like, you're talking about, like, he lost the ability to go and leave Isabeau to do something else. Like, that's...
Well, I'm not even sure if
well,
that's
you, if
the
you're
case.
Going on a quest, she's not tagging along.
Yeah, well, I mean, but that's something you come home to, right? Like, I don't know what the motive... He
so
never got to do
upset
it,
so he's upset
right?
he doesn't get to go away from her to do something else?
What makes you think he'd be doing it alone?
Like, that time frame,
just,
I don't think
just,
so.
But you're just assuming, so...
Yeah, no, like I said, and we're talking about purposes, and yeah. right... the logistics of that, women overthinking things all the time.
I know, right?
no.
And she's just assuming he's going to be misogynistic about it, too.
Yes.
Well, I'm assuming medieval Europe is going to be misogynistic for him.
Yes, no, and I see your point.
I don't believe any women were tagging along in the Crusades, as far as I could tell.
No, and I mean, it's a...
I'm sure she has
flaw,
important
but,
shit to do, too.
But, I mean, what we're saying, though, is that story is the first real opportunity to display his motivations, right? The fact that all these things have been taken away from him. This family honor, or this opportunity to fulfill his family duty. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the woman he loves is taken away, right? How that works, you're right, it's flawed, but... Mm. Really, it's...
And honestly, I'd like to know what else was taken from her. I mean, we really yeah. only yeah. know about this love for him, but what else did
I
she
I know,
lose?
It's so upsetting. Right? I'm like going, dude, like, she has to have more going on. They kind of hint at she was mm-hmm. sent there for some reason, and they never really get into that.
She must have had some importance, because, like, the bishops was into her.
Well, he...
So, I get the feeling that there was maybe something political
yeah,
involved there.
Yeah, because Imperius
maybe
was talking...
Maybe she's royalty of some sort.
Yeah, Imperius talking about, like, her father, and he's like, he was a terrible person, and they just... That's one line, and they throw it away, and they mm-hmm. don't really talk about it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, I'm kind of curious as what his quest would have been.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, I've certainly, what would the quest have been? But really, like he said, now my only quest is to kill the bishop, right? So whatever he was supposed to do.
But maybe his quest would be to free Aquila from a very corrupt person in charge.
Her father?
Maybe, or the bishop.
Bom, bom, bom. Oh, man, they're just, I mean...
Like, to free Aquila from the bishop's
yeah,
claws
I mean, the
would be a great
conflict.
Quest.
I mean,
and the fact he couldn't even realize that was his quest.
Yeah, if you tell us her dad's a shit, then tell me more about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Like yeah. Is
the bishop in some sort of evil pact with this
yeah.
guy?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, there's a fucking plot point there that's awesome.
Yeah, or even, like, but yeah, like, to even maybe be that... Maybe Navarre doesn't even realize that maybe this is his holy quest to save
mm-hmm.
these and, people from.
And she's part of that quest at
yeah.
that point, right? Now she's not taken off because that's part of the mission.
So the restoration
right?
at the end of this movie is his family's honor and the fulfillment of this quest yeah. and his purpose and Isabeau. Yeah.
Eh?
Oh, look, nice, neat little bow.
like, yeah, like his quest, maybe he was just misled by believing his quest was something completely different.
And in case you guys haven't missed that transition, we have now just slid into remake territory.
Woohoo!
We kind of always were, actually, on this one.
yeah, we started off at the beginning from
well,
that.
Well, I mean, there's not a lot of plot to get into, and we're kind of hitting it as we go with this one. And,
yeah.
It's got the story, the meat of the story works, there's just not enough of it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you give more of these characters things to do, I mean, now the bishop's got something to do? Honestly, that's a place where you start the story just a wee bit earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have Mouse getting caught in this conflict. Maybe he's before we can... I don't know. You can see him in the background. I feel like there's a small story you need to
yeah.
work up with and give a little bit of that history with Navarre, why he left the guard in the first place. Mm-hmm. Well, we know why. He was caught in this romance with somebody that the bishop was into, but why was he into her in the first place? Why was she even there?
Mm-hmm.
So if you make that conflict... And there was this possible other mission. Maybe he worked for an honorable person before the bishop came in and was given the power.
Or maybe yeah. his family had
right?
served the royal family before, like
right.
in terms of captain of the guard. And their loyalty was to the royal family, and the bishop
yeah.
just usurped all
and
of
that.
And
his loyalty is still to the good king or this good person who...
Very Robin Hood, yeah.
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
we keep going back to it, but really...
But there's a lot of Robin Hood
of,
in
yeah,
this story.
There really mm-hmm. is. No, and I mean, I think right at the beginning, like you said...
Because the Sheriff of Nottingham was totally into...
Oh, yeah.
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 yeah. Right at the beginning, is like you could play Mouse's Escape almost beat for beat,
mm-hmm.
but intercutting that with the gallows scene and then them going in to find him, mm-hmm. That could be shortened, and there could be a scene right at the beginning, shortly before that, mm-hmm. where he tells the bishop, like you said, right?
Like here's, he finds incriminating evidence yeah, against the bishop.
Here's mm-hmm. what the thief took.
Yeah.
We've got him down, and then the bishop says, okay, I want him hung today.
Yes.
And that's the motivation.
Yeah, it's got to be something personal for him, or maybe it's something that could prove what he's been doing mm-hmm. against the king's wishes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that, right. those motivations.
But you know what? I mean, you don't even need to see it,
no.
right?
No.
Right?
But as long as... God, I mean, they always tell you little bits of dialogue, but that would have been a big one.
Because yeah. there's a tiny one where, like, they're asking why he's so upset and, like, all... going after this one little thief mm-hmm. and I think it's Marquette is asking like why are you so worried and the bishop is like only like one tiny little thing can bring the whole thing down so maybe
yeah and he's upset one because no one's defiance. Ever yeah
yeah
and but no that, one's ever skipped the dungeons
just,
right
I just don't feel like that's enough honestly
no but I mean like we introduced that into our story and it yeah. makes more sense that was
oh sure
why he's so worried about Mouse
yeah Yeah, I just want Mouse to have more to do, too. More reason to run.
To be more in part of the story.
Well, to be more part of the story. And given the nature of the Mouse, he probably didn't know what he had.
Mm-hmm.
No, he just took stuff. I mean, he was an opportunist. He took whatever suited his needs at the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
If he needed clothes, he stole clothes. If he needed money, he stole money, right? He was just surviving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, he was all about surviving, and that was sometimes through lying, cheating, and stealing.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's the whole thing you talk about, the Black Plague. It took his family, maybe, and that's how he got by.
Poor Mouse, the worst things happen to him when he's actually telling the truth.
Yes, which was a great comedic effect.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and internal conflict for him as well, with, again, this conversation with God all the time.
Yeah, and...
In a way, that is... His way of breaking the fourth wall is, you know, he is the audience or God that he's talking to. So,
yeah, no. So I mean, that would be a great way to tie in a little more motivation for why he's so important to the bishop and to the captain of the guard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also why he does not want to go back to Aquila at all.
Exactly. Yes, mm-hmm. because I think he suspected but didn't really know. Like that would be the way to play it, right? It's like mm-hmm. whatever I took, I wasn't supposed to see. Right? I don't know what I saw, but I know I wasn't supposed to see it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that could even be a line. It's like, I stole something from the bishop. I don't know what it was, but I wasn't supposed to see it.
Yeah, he's mm-hmm. very mad about that.
Yeah, right? I mean, that could play into his interactions with Navarre.
Yeah, and that gives them actually something to fucking talk about.
Yeah.
While they're together, because those scenes are so awkward.
Oh, true.
Yeah, and honestly...
They have no chemistry together whatsoever.
Yeah, I was about to say, those two didn't have any chemistry.
No.
That's why they need the horse there, because the horse and Matthew Broderick have great chemistry.
Yeah. Yes, they do. Everybody else in Matthew Broderick has great chemistry except for Navarre.
I always felt like there should have been more scenes with the horse.
What I liked is they used like kind of a proper horse. Yeah. Like those are those large kind of they're light draft horses. Yeah. They're ones that are big and strong enough to carry a knight full armor.
They were war horses.
Well,
right?
I won't say anything bad about at least most of the period accuracy. Some of the helmets and things got a bit wonky, but the sets and most of the costuming would still stand up today. I mean, whoever was working hair that day, I'm like, dude, you just turn on your TV and do that hairstyle? Because seriously, everybody had modern haircuts and that drove me just batty. Like, you couldn't have fucking afforded a wig? Jesus.
Yeah.
Granted, Michelle Pfeiffer looked awesome. Her hair was awesome. But come on, give me some period hair. Like,
yeah, because she would not have had short hair.
No, but none of them would have.
No, they would
maybe Navarre would have.
Navarre would have maybe shoulder length.
And it would have been.
You still would have had to show him away from the guard from that time.
And it would have been certainly more about that bowl cut that Broderick had briefly a couple times in it. But that was the closest to an authentic haircut that we saw.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, I think.
And
yeah,
even then, not really, because it just was the same haircut he had in Ferris Bueller. So
true. Like Navarre would have had more of that. And I'd say the one thing about Lord of the Rings, the haircuts are great. But that long hair of
Aragorn.
Yeah, Aragorn. It's an Aragornish look that he probably would have had.
I mean, there were a couple of guys. I felt Marquette looked a little bit more of the time.
Yeah.
Yes.
So. Alfred Molina, definitely.
Yeah, they dirtied him up pretty good.
Yeah.
Again, he had short hair, but still.
And the bishop looked okay because most of the time he had his hat on, right? Or his, I don't know what they're called. thing, those big tall things.
His topper.
Yeah. Yeah, his cake topper.
That's all I know what they are, because they're huge.
Yeah,
Yeah, yeah, they actually have a name, but and I thought I knew it, but I don't.
I don't.
Yeah. The big hat.
Yeah, but...
You know it when you see it.
It could be a
everybody
good
knows what the big hat is.
Yes, everybody's seen him. The Pope wears it all the time.
The Pope hat.
But yeah, we're seeing that there's a good movie here. It's just...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just got to richen it up a little bit with a little more.
It's just not, especially given the runtime, there's just really feels like everybody's just standing around like awkward scene, and oh, we got something to do now.
Yeah. I would love to keep that scene where they first camp with the farmer and his wife, because it ties a bunch of things together. It's his first interaction with Isabeau.
Well, we need to see more of Aquila to begin with. I felt like these mm-hmm. houses were miles apart.
It was a full day's travel away. Yeah. But why they were traveling so far away when he wants to get back is the question.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And we have to address that. There's a scene where when they first drive up to that farm, that shitty little farm, mm-hmm. and the wife. You need that. She's running with her arms out.
Going,
yes, it was
so timid. And why did that farmer suddenly turn into Jason Voorhees? He's just stroking that axe, waiting for everybody to fall asleep so he can murder him at night.
Know.
I'm like, what is going on with this guy?
Maybe it's a take on, remember, there's that family in like the 1800s that people used to stay at their house and they all died, and anybody who stayed there was never heard from again. Maybe that's these people.
Yeah, maybe.
They're like cannibals that will eat these people.
But yeah, it was. I have to say, it was a high point of the movie for me, because with her running through the field, I mean, with the arms.
There were some just weird reactions in this whole movie, but that was definitely the weirdest. Mm-hmm. Just their reaction to these strangers, and then, you know, we got money. Yeah, okay, you can stay in the barn. Never actually getting close enough to make a transaction, and then he's going to murder them in their sleep anyway. So I guess that was just to take the money.
True.
Yes.
I thought at one point, though, I thought they were acting weird because he was on a nice horse and had like nice armor. I thought it was kind of an extension of that whole where the bishop's guards were taking everybody's money and they're like, we're fucked, these people are here again, like, yeah. That's what I thought that reaction was supposed to be.
Yeah. Well, Isabeau's, oh man, speaking of weird reactions again, and I got it to a certain extent, it just, the scene didn't work very well. Isabeau's reaction to Cesar when she stumbles across him in the forest and sees all the wolf skins on the back of his horse, she just flips. Obviously,
well, that's just outside the stable.
Yeah, outside the stable. It flips, obviously thinking that one of them is Navarre. But you're seeing more than one. You have no, like, that initial reaction, and then she kind of runs off freaked out. That scene doesn't work very well. Like, there should have been a little bit more trauma there, I think, thinking about it. And that's when Broderick was just like, no, that's not Navarre.
Yeah.
And there's no conflict at all, when he falls back into his own trap. Mm-hmm. Like, there should have been a fucking fight.
Absolutely. And
yeah.
I mean,
that's when the wolf, there should have been fucking wrestling with the wolf, everything.
There's, yeah, I think the wolf should have ripped his throat out.
Yes.
And goddamn right.
Yeah. I like the irony of him getting caught in his own
me
trap.
Too.
Yeah.
I did too. Yeah. I would have liked some conflict and as he falls over into his trap. Like, they're just needed
to
be
driven
more
into it by the wolf. Yeah.
Yeah. After some tussling.
Yeah. I mean, I think
there needs to be tension.
Just something just occurred to me that's, I think, may have sort of explained why Jay doesn't like Mouse so much. Is Mouse's, even though he really is the lead character in the movie, he's very fucking passive.
Yeah.
Right? There's no, aside from the very end, there's no real redemption for him. And even then,
no.
It's pretty passive.
Yeah, that's true. He has no arc. Yeah. He's just there to facilitate what other characters need. Mm-hmm. And no resolution to his own conflict. Would have been something if we got a little bit of, you know, when those characters finally break the curse and come back together, just a little nod up going, all right, you got one right.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. But you know what? And in the end, I mean, he just leaves.
He just leaves.
He literally just leaves.
Yeah, we don't
see. He and Imperius leave.
We don't see any resolution to his internal conflict at all. We don't really see, I mean, Imperius gets a little bit of his satisfaction in resolving his guilt, but again, we don't see it.
Yeah, and there's no reward. I mean, no. There really is very little character growth even.
No, right? Yeah.
And I mean, I felt that that was what was intended for the movie, is largely to show the growth of Mouse from being a common street pickpocket to somebody who's got strength of character and has found his moral compass and has grown. And
we need more of that with Navarre as well. Mm-hmm. Like, we needed to see that bitterness that had grown in him. We need to see that melt away.
Yeah.
But that bitterness is so crucial to that final scene because...
That there's not enough after that final scene. Like, okay, if they're just going to be there... And that's part of our remake. If we're going to have a little bit more politics of Navarre, maybe we can see some more resolution to that as well and give with Navarre's other journey.
Yeah, like I think you could have it where it's not so much like you're saying the bitterness is part of it and he has to have his vengeance, but maybe just like a bit of hope. Mm-hmm. Like he seems a little more hopeful, like and begins to give a little bit more thought to like, oh, maybe we could break this curse.
Like, I'm not saying hand him the kingdom or anything.
No, but just give a little bit of hope.
Yeah, well, and just the curse, you still want that curse ended at the end of the movie.
Oh, you do.
But
he doesn't believe it's going to end.
I feel like his personal journey as well. Yeah, well, he had given up right away. He even when the eclipse is just kind of dawning on him and they were going to euthanize the bird.
Yeah, he was going to have her killed.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you don't make that decision for me. Fuck you.
I didn't like that at all.
No.
Yeah, I that's the one thing that has always bothered me about this movie. I'm like, why does he get to make that
decision?
That's
a missed ending.
Yeah.
Have anybody seen that movie?
No.
No? The Mist?
The Mist, yeah.
Oh my God, what a bummer ending. They're trying to escape the Mist.
That's a gut punch of an ending.
And then the car dies and they're like,
he only has
do you guys want to
so
get eaten by
bullets?
Monsters? And they were one bullet short, so he's like, okay, it's a mercy killing for everybody in the vehicle.
Including his own son.
Including his own son. So he shoots everybody but himself, and he's willing to get eaten. And then the Mist drifts away.
And the military comes
through, and they rescued all the people from the shopping mall, or the grocery store, are on the back of this truck. And he just murdered his entire family.
Oh, yeah, that's a
gut punch.
Oh, my God. That makes me uncomfortable right now just thinking about it.
Yeah.
Oh.
So, like, God, what if you would have killed Isabeau and when you just make the realization what how to break the curse?
Yeah, no. And I mean,
let's not do that.
They played that tension very well. That was one of the things that was well done, is playing that tension very well.
It's just not delivered very well. Like, still think it's a good scene. It's just, again, the tension in the scene isn't there. I think the tension of that works. I think you also need to establish maybe that they still believed in the stars, and I feel like some of a lot of that mystical stuff outside the curse, that's just not there in the movie.
No.
Like this bishop who's playing with black magic and making pacts with demons, it's implied. I actually want to see some of that.
Like, there should be more
if
fantasy.
If you're going to make a fantasy movie, put some fantasy in it.
Yeah.
Outside of their transformations.
Because that's really the only fantasy that's in there, right? And,
yeah.
And
that could add more conflict. Maybe Cesar gets some sort of bestial transformation. Maybe he turns into a giant bear.
Maybe.
Demon
I don't
bear
know.
Thingy. I don't know. I just there's more conflict to happen there.
Or there's somebody who serves under the bishop as... Like, there's maybe some sort of black magic practitioner that's another character we see a bit of, but has, hooks him up. That also needs to be killed. I don't know.
Well, yeah, how did he make the pact in the first place? Is there a phone book for demons?
Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I mean, they never really do address any of that, obviously.
No. Maybe that's the demon.
Maybe.
Preying on his weaknesses, and he just... That's his eternal struggle, right? And he gives into his weaknesses.
Right, and maybe, you know what?
Because everybody's got these little arcs, and we just, nothing's there. He's a mustache-twirling bad guy.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking, it's like, maybe the bishop wasn't that bad of a guy, right? And then he becomes obsessed with Isabeau, and then there's this whole, maybe he doesn't go to the demon comes to him and starts preying on his insecurities.
Yeah. I mean, maybe he's always there. I like the idea of him being a counterpoint to Mouse's conflict with God and his beliefs. And while he's losing his own. You know, they're a good counterpoint to each other.
They would be a very good counterpoint
to
each other.
Like how Mouse becomes even more sort of on the right of things, and the Bishop kind of going downhill, like, but probably honestly believing he's not doing too much wrong.
No, because maybe he doesn't even believe it's a demon. Maybe he genuinely believes that this is God's will.
Oh, yeah. Right? I can believe somebody going that nutcase. Cause yeah. And he does actually use that at one point to tell people, as like, God told me that Navarre was against. Like, that's an outright lie. You can see he's overtly lying there.
Yes. But I think maybe, I mean, you could have him genuinely believing everything he's saying.
Yeah, which would make him like a tragic figure, but I think he has to sort of have a sense that he knows part of it is wrong. Yeah. I feel if you're going to have like the villain, like, you know how you hate a villain who's like completely evil, like you need to sympathize a little bit. That's great, but when you sympathize maybe a little too much, like you should have it so that you can see the problem.
You know, I'm not saying turn him into Magneto where he suddenly, you know, the more recent X-Men movies are kind of made him a good bad guy.
But see how he can be, he's changed, he's been corrupted by...
We now live in a world where the bad guys are getting a little more motivated and we're seeing their sides because nobody's just good or evil. He's got to believe in what he's doing.
Here's the thing, you can find people doing the most heinous shit
in
the name of God and thinking they're doing just fine.
Yeah, exactly.
So you don't even have to travel very far for his character.
The history books are filled with that. So
exactly. So yeah, you don't have to go very far for that character.
No, and that was the point I was trying to make. Right? Yeah. Where he believes that what he's doing is still godly.
I think still at some point too, I think you have to kind of point where he may have a sort of hint where he's like, yeah, I'm just going to do this because I can do this.
Yeah. Oh,
I'm God's guy. It doesn't matter.
There have to be those moments there, right? For sure.
Yeah. More well-rounded characters, more to do, more fantasy. I think we've got a decent structure for a remake, a good skeleton for a remake.
Oh, and a really good swordmaster for the few fight scenes that are going to be in it.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I say, like, I maybe introduce a character or two that is still loyal to Navarre.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. That's...
I want to see some of the guard be conflicted or maybe interact with Navarre during one of their altercations and be like, don't go back to Aquila. They are hunting you down.
Well, you give Marquette one other guy, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Marquette's the Vader character to the Emperor, then you give Marquette that guy that used to work for Navarre.
Yeah.
Right? As the next highest ranking guardsman. Inevitably.
Who's doing his orders, but he doesn't really like
it. The internal supporting character that's going to die.
Oh, yeah.
But
the poor guy.
Yeah.
Oh, like the guy at the beginning where he's like, hey, Navarre, and then the guy pushes him on his sword.
Yeah. That lasted a little longer than that.
Yeah, that's basically, I think that's our character, but he just gets to live a little longer.
Yes. Right. And maybe he's the one who's been feeding Navarre information about the bishop. And like he's got
an inside guy.
At least one inside guy.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe he's so covertly still talking up Navarre and checking people out to see who's still kind of loyal to him and who's sort of against the church but can't really show it yet.
Yeah, right? Well, against the bishop.
Against the bishop,
like, we'll be like, we just need this guy out.
And everything will be fine, yeah.
Hey, you could have the messages being delivered by Isabeau in her bird form. Give her more to do, too, as a bird.
And she is a hawk. Like, she can make that...
I mean, she's not a messenger.
And if we don't put them so far away from Aquila, she could easily do that.
Yeah.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. And I think we need to talk about the wolf a little bit, because, I mean, Isabeau as the bird is clearly quite aware of what's going on around her. I mean, she's still got a bird brain, pardon the phrasing, but but she's interacting with him and with other people that come in contact with, right? Whereas the wolf, it's feral. It's a wolf, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a disconnect there too. I think that at one point the wolf chose not to attack her, but that's the only indication you know that the wolf is aware of her.
Yeah, I think the wolf would not want to leave her.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Is that wolf is definitely needs to be more aware of her and maybe not be as interactive as he is with her as the hawk, but definitely that needs to be more of that, right? That she has some sort of influence over that wolf.
Mm-hmm. They sort of hint at it at the beginning when he first sees her as she walks out and the wolf kind of just hangs out.
Yes.
That's it. But I feel that should be more of that relationship with wolves. Like, oh, hey, how you doing? Like,
Yeah. No, I mean, it doesn't have to be like a big pet cuddly dog.
No.
That's not the character or a wolf.
Right? Yeah, I think.
But it would recognize Isabeau and be like, all right.
I think there should be more growl. And I think that was kind of what they were trying to go for, is have these characters represent their animals. But I just didn't see that with Rutger Hauer, whereas I certainly saw the grace within Michelle Pfeiffer in her scenes. And I don't know if they were deliberate bird-like movements and the blue eyes and things like that, but there's certain aspects there that you can make some arguments for, that in human and bird form you could see some similarities between the two.
Yeah, like she's paying attention. Like the thing where she's sitting there, go, oh, he's taking us back. Like she knows. She knows what's going on. Mm-hmm. She's like, because she looks around. That's what a hawk would do.
No, and that they developed her character very well, but the wolf and Navarre were never really developed. Mm-hmm. They were there without being present.
Yeah. He doesn't really remember things as the wolf.
But I would say just recognizing Isabeau is enough.
I would play that up a little bit as him not accepting that. Like, I think in a way Isabeau kind of accepted this as like, okay, this is the way things are right now. It sucks, but accepting the moment, and that kind of allows her to be aware.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas he's not accepting any of it at all. He's just sheer vengeance, and that should be that. That's a point I think maybe they could push forward a little bit more as well. That, I mean, it makes sense. He's not accepting the role. He's, you know, internally he's not going to remember either. So, just driven by hate and revenge, but it's just not really there in the character.
No, it's not.
Well, we've got a movie. Mm-hmm. Let's cast it.
Yeah.
Right? Who wants to go?
Dan?
Okay, I always seem to go first, eh?
I always like to hear what yours are first, because I'm never really that excited about my own.
Okay, well, let's see here. So, I'm going to start with my director, because I think he's a good director, and I think he could do the action scenes and the romance. Mm-hmm. I chose Peter Berg.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I think he can pull that off.
I don't care what anybody says, I still like Battleship.
I have yet to see it. I still want to see it. So
Clue
for
is
Mouse,
a better board game movie.
Yeah, or Philippe Gaston, I picked Daniel Radcliffe.
Oh, nice.
Okay.
Yeah, small.
That's good.
I considered it.
Yeah. So for Captain Navarre, I can't say his name very well, I'm afraid. I'm not sure if it's pronounced Nikolai Coster-Waldau from Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I totally see him in that role.
And he does good that whole area of time or medievalness or fantasy.
That's
why I picked
him, because he's already got the swordcraft. He's big, he's imposing, but he still looks like a romantic lead.
Mm-hmm.
So for Isabeau, I picked, and another name I can't say, it's Saoirse Ronan. Again, she has that ethereal look to her.
That's a good choice.
Yeah. For Imperius, I picked Michael Gambon.
Oh, nice. Wait, is he the one that's alive?
Yeah, he's still alive.
Okay, because I was remembering one of the Dumbledores is dead.
Yeah,
I can never remember who's dead.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. I was very close to casting him in the same part, and I'm like, I changed my mind a little bit.
Yeah. So for the bishop, I went a little off to left field. I went with Hugh Laurie as the bishop.
Oh, nice. Yeah, nice.
That's a good choice.
He could
That's
do evil.
That's a really good choice.
Yes. For Marquette, I'm not sure how many people have watched Vikings, but I picked George Blagden from Vikings. He played the priest in Vikings. I think he could play that Sheriff of Nottingham very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to cast Cesar, but I just couldn't think of anybody that I would put in that role except for Alfred Molina.
Yeah, I thought about that.
So I went completely the opposite direction. I went with Simon Pegg. I think it'd be fun to see him play that type of character.
You could totally change up Cesar. That'd be awesome.
That would play with what I originally had in mind as a remake, because I was going to go Knight's Tale vibe with it.
Yeah,
and he would totally play very well.
I thought he would bring a very different kind of menace to it.
Uh-huh.
And I think it'd be fun to see him in that kind of role.
Yeah.
right?
I could see him all dirtied up and being, but yeah, but still there's an air. He would be more verbal of a character,
yeah.
I feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it wasn't offhand. I'm like, just, oh yeah, I'm still Simon Pegg in there. No, there was rationale behind picking him.
I love that.
And that was my cast.
I went tall, menacing. Now I'm embarrassed by it.
Oh, I'm not. Yeah, I'm like, I'm not as confident in my cast now. I don't know what to say.
I'm sorry.
I like my cast, but my Cesari's weak. I'll admit it.
Yeah, so that was me.
Yeah, I didn't get Cesar because I was looking around. I'm like, oh, nobody else but him. I didn't think outside the box.
I almost kept Melina in it.
I thought about that.
I almost did.
Screw
it. Alfred Molina. That's going to be my Cesar.
All right.
I'm not going to fight it anymore.
Because for the most part, I was trying to stay away from original cast in this one.
Oh, I didn't. I did some stunt casting.
Okay, go ahead.
All right. Okay, for my Navarre, I have Alexander Skarsgård. I like him. Tall, blonde. He's pretty good.
Okay.
I think I can take it.
That's good.
For Isabeau, Natalie Dormer.
Game of Thrones, and I just why I didn't go with her was because I'd already picked...
Yeah,
but I was deliberately staying away from Game of Thrones, although one of my choices I found out later wasn't.
See, I wasn't staying away from Game of Thrones specifically, but because she's got like this strange ethereal look about her, I'm like, I kind of like it. Plus, I always wanted somebody like kind of close enough in age with the guy I put as Navarre.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want it eerie or creepy.
Yeah, well, I did see Navarre and Isabeau as having a sort of an age gap, so I was comfortable with going with a younger actress in that role.
Mm-hmm. I was like, no.
Which
I
also would have been fitting with the time, too.
True, but I didn't want to do that. So, the bishop, I put Julian Sands.
Very nice.
Very nice.
As the bishop. Now,
I'm still on board with Hugh Laurie. But I'm a big supporter of Julian Sands. So.
I know, and I think he could... He's great at evil. I love him doing evil. And with the fantasy element as being like a bishop, you can imagine him doing some sort of dark mass to make this curse happen.
Yeah, warlock.
Julian Sands will nail this shit.
And numerous other... B horror films. I mean, he was the king of the B horror.
Arachnophobia.
Yeah,
he was a good guy in that one.
I know, but he was awesome in it too. Yeah. Okay, and as I say, my stunt casting, I put Rutger Hauer as Imperius.
Yeah,
I toyed with it, but honestly, I'm like, yeah, I'll do it.
With both of your choices, like I almost went with Gambon for mine, but I'm like, there is some physical stuff, and like like Michael Gambon's like I think close to 80, and Rutger's like 71.
Yeah, but he just recently did Hobo with a Shotgun.
Yeah, a couple of years. He would have still been late 60s, but still, it's not a very physical role either.
No, but I mean, he can still move around, I think, a lot easier than our previous Imperius.
I considered it, but I think maybe because I just didn't like most of these people the first time around. True. I didn't want any of them back.
Yeah.
And as you know, like Cesar, I kept Alfred Molina.
Yeah.
Because that's what I'm going to do.
Fair.
Marquette, Peter Bergen.
Like, give him a second shot at it.
I can't remember if Peter Bergen's still alive, but I was like, Peter Bergen for Marquette.
Okay.
I don't know why. And then the mouse, I did another Game of Thrones thing, but I forgot he was on Game of Thrones because he was like a late season person in a season I never watched. Thomas Brody Sangster. He was originally the young kid in Love Actually. He's kind of a lanky, blonde kind of kid, British.
Okay.
Now I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
So that's what I did, and I didn't have a director. I should have done that.
Yeah, everybody had some great bishops.
It's
bishops are awesome,
and it's such a rich. I don't know. I think the way we've got this figured out, it's going to be a much richer character.
Yeah.
So we cast accordingly.
Now. I'll probably backtrack on my director, but I originally, in my mind, before we started fleshing this out for the podcast, I kind of wanted to do a Knight's Tale kind of take on it. I'm like, well, if you're going to go stupid-ass music, go all the way and you know, break the fourth wall, don't take it too seriously. So for a director, I went with Brian Helgeland, who directed Knight's Tale, as well as the more thriller... religious thriller The Order. So, and most recently we just talked about him on Payback episode.
Mm-hmm. I'm not familiar with The Order. I have to watch that.
Yeah, it was good.
It was not bad.
Yeah. And one of my actors comes from both Knight's Tale and The Order, and that is Mark Addy for Imperius.
Yeah.
Who also wound up on Game of Thrones.
He is good.
He would be very good in that part.
He'd be a great Imperius.
He was the first one I had. I'm like, totally. This guy would be a great Imperius. He's got this similar physical presence.
Yeah. If I hadn't seen him in the full Monty, I would think he was always in medieval times.
In his mid-50s, I think he can still do a bit more physical role that we could maybe impart in our remake. So for my Gaston, for my mouse, I went with Robert Sheehan from Misfits. Or Mortal Instruments, City of Bones for the American audiences who haven't seen Misfits. Good Irish actor. I think he'd be an interesting choice. And he's proven he's really good with dialogue.
Oh, he's very good with dialogue.
Mm-hmm. So,
well, he's Irish. We talk a lot.
I don't know if he can suppress that Irish accent enough, though. But damn. Yeah, I think if anybody could deliver all that dialogue of Mouse, I think it'd be him.
To be fair, if you're going in that vein, just like a mixture of different accents, I don't think it's going to be that noticeable.
That's true. It was all over the place in this movie, too.
Yeah.
And for Navarre, I had Ed Skrein from Deadpool. He was the villain in Deadpool. He was Ajax.
He's good. I don't know.
I'm like, okay.
As a romantic lead, it'd be tough.
I don't know. I mean, because we've seen him as a villain. I'm like, you know, and I kept thinking about it. And I'm like, I don't know. He's got that something that is, I could see that they saw in Rutger Hauer in that part. And I'm like, he could be a lead. I'd want to give him that opportunity.
Yeah. You know, as a romantic lead, give him that go.
You know, and he's still a, you know, tall, good-looking guy, fit, and he could totally do all that swordplay stuff. So.
And he does strike me as somebody who could, like, come off as, like, that very high captain of the guard
type. Yeah, so I think he could totally be an action hero if we want to give him more action-y stuff to do. As I said, Imperius, I got that one. For my Bishop, I went with Bill Nighy. He's such a great villain, but I seem to be married to House at this moment after Sam said it. So.
I know.
No, because Bill Nighy was actually on my list as well. Yeah. Because
he would be a great evil bishop priest guy.
Well, you know,
but my love for Bill Nighy, he won't let me make him a villain.
He's been a villain more than he's been.
But I love him so much, I don't want to do it in our movies.
Yeah, you know what? We could have him as the voice that talks the bishop into his
The demonic voice.
Yeah.
Oh, I do like that.
Be the voice that. Or the demon that's talked about.
And
into
we could still keep our Nighy in there. But yeah. All right, I like that. I like that.
Nice.
I like that. Man, for Marquette, I was all over the place, and I finally settled on Matthias Varela, which we recently discussed on Point Break.
Oh yeah.
So he was my Marquette as the new captain of the guard, the evil guy. I really liked him in that movie. And I'm like, with the name, I feel he's going to be a Spaniard.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, I wanted to kind of keep somebody who could pull that off.
Yes.
For my Isabeau, I went with Rebecca Ferguson. She was in Mission Impossible Rogue Nation most recently.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, because Michelle Pfeiffer, she's got that statuesque beauty, and I was trying to think of that while still being a character who could have a commanding presence while she's in her human form. And we do like our leading ladies to have more to do and more motivation. So I'm like, oh, she'd be a good, powerful lead.
Mm-hmm. And I think there should be more like with Isabeau kind of taking care of herself at night. Like she's trying to catch a rabbit at one point.
That's why I picked who I did was because she's done those physical roles.
Oh, yeah. And Natalie Dormer, I think, can do that too.
That's again why I picked her. She's done action roles. So when you're thinking about an action sequence with Cesar, you know, I want somebody who can hold her own a bit before the wolf shows up.
Yeah. Yeah, you can make conflict. It's more of where, the captain of the guard, Navarre, has shown her a few things.
Yeah,
because he wants her to be safe while
And speaking of Cesar, I wanted somebody big and imposing who, you know, could be a trapper who could trap with his bare fucking hands.
Nice.
I went with Robert Millay. And he was the big dude in Sherlock Holmes. He was the Russian in Pacific Rim. He used to wrestle under the name Kurgan, but he went into acting fairly quickly. His wrestling career was a blip on the radar.
His wrestling career was getting into acting.
He's not great with dialogue, but it's not a scene that requires it. So.
No, because he has very little dialogue in there.
Yeah, but he's huge. He's got to be like 7 feet tall. This guy's a massive dude.
Nice.
Yeah, so he's a big dude. So, yeah, that's my cast. You know, I think we all did awesome picks on this.
Mm.
I love it. I love the Hugh Laurie in that role.
Yeah.
I really do.
And I like the idea of like having casting our demon as Bill Nighy.
Yeah.
They can both pull off menace very well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I know that Hugh Laurie likes not doing comedy. Like, he likes to break away from the comedy from time to time.
Well, he played comedy for so long before House. So playing that gnarly guy, and even then, House could be pretty damn funny at times, but in that surly way.
Yeah. But what's funny about that, too, is like there's a whole bunch of people who only see Hugh Laurie as like the dramatic guy from House.
Yeah.
They've never seen his other stuff. Like
Blackadder. And,
or a bit of Fry and Laurie.
Fry and Laurie, where he's really funny.
Oh, my God, so good.
Yeah. So, yeah, that'd be good. I mean, he's a very well-rounded actor. We just don't get to see a lot of it, so.
Yeah. Cool.
Okay, well, who would you guys at home cast? Let us know in our comment section on Facebook. It's Invasion of the Remake on Facebook, at Invasion Remake on Twitter, or invasiontheremake@gmail.com. If you could suggest, we didn't even discuss soundtrack and who would be a better musician.
Anybody.
Anybody.
I think, I think we left that wide open.
I feel like, it's pretty much anybody's game at this point. If you guys have somebody who could score this movie a lot better, or maybe think of a favorite soundtrack, let us know in the comments, and I might talk about that in a future episode. And of course, speaking of music, we're still looking for music. If you want to be featured on the show, let us know. Drop us your tracks. If you have a segment intro or an intro to the show we might use, it's all cool. We'll run it, and we'll give you credit and direct you on the notes to whatever pages you want us to direct you to, all that good stuff, and we'll make you famous
ish.
We'll make you Canadian
hundreds
famous
of people around the globe.
Literally tens of people will know who you are.
Tens up to hundreds of people globally.
It is global.
it's not like a lot of people, but we cover a lot of the globe.
We're realistic. We're podcasters. Let's be realistic. Thousands, maybe. No, we're definitely getting there, and Player FM has been a big help to us, and you guys can help us gain a much bigger audience by leaving comments on iTunes and Stitcher and places like Player FM and Audio Boom and Google Play Music. Just get us out there. That always, when you leave a review and 5 stars, it's whatever stupid algorithm that these guys use. But if people are interacting, it gets that podcast noticed, and then we can maybe get into that featured podcast territory that will be seen on the front page, like we were most recently seen on Player FM. Mm-hmm. So we just need you guys to do that. It takes 2 minutes to write a couple sentences. It takes a tenth of a second to click that star, 5 stars.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and like and share on Facebook. Retweet us on Twitter.
Please do. Yeah, if you see us a post on an episode or
if you want to tweet us something some you think we were so silly to totally miss out on.
Yeah, it was really cool. One of our fans, Matthew, just recently lent us a movie to watch. I don't know if we'll cover it on the show, but we're definitely going to take
we're
a look at
it.
It was called Hard Rock Zombies, and if you guys are following us, you probably saw that interaction on Facebook. So there's a reason to follow us, because things go on, and we might actually take your suggestions to heart and feature it on the show.
Mm-hmm.
That's right, because we're awesome like that. Because you guys are our invaders. You're our soldiers out in the battlefield.
Yeah, and if you guys want to hear us talk about something, hey, we like to talk. So
yeah,
tell us what you want us to talk about, and we will.
To be honest, there's probably a bunch of stuff. Like, there's a bunch of movies we haven't even heard of, and we would like to hear about
them. We have an endless supply of movies to feature on this show, but we'd like it if you guys wanted us to do it. Just don't ask me about The Fly or The Thing. They're coming. Don't worry about it. I have a spot for them, but they're not coming too soon just yet. So.
Yeah. But those other ones that haven't been remade, but we never would have heard about, those would be interesting. Because, we're always looking for something new there.
Yeah, totally.
And the more obscure and fun it is, the more fun we have.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I've got a good one lined up. I don't know where we're placing that one yet, but it's good. When I suggested it to these guys, they're like, I didn't know that existed. So that's a good one. But I'm not telling you what it is. Spoilers. Even we have spoilers. So
Yeah, we don't have spoilers on the movies we talk about that were made 30 years ago. We mean spoilers within the podcast. Spoilers.
That's right. I'm not gonna. I'll spoil the movies, but I won't spoil my own podcast.
There we go.
All right. Well, we're gonna close out with the woman who named herself after this movie, Lady Hawk. We're just gonna play a little bit of it. So you guys, if you dig it,
go find her.
She's got 3 albums. And just go download them off iTunes and support the artists. So
yeah,
go check that out. All right. I'm Jason.
I'm Sam.
I am Trish.
Guess what?
We're out of here.
Nice.
We did it. You came to my show and I saw you in the crowd.